And those four beasts correspond to the four parts of the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream in chapter 2. And so in the fourth part of the image, we've got the part of the image with feet, legs of iron, feet of iron and clay. And then we have that fourth beast in Daniel 7 with teeth of iron, so that it is the same one. It is the fourth empire. And so by John's using extensively, he refers extensively to the points that Daniel makes about that fourth beast. I believe there can be no doubt that at least at this time, this beast is representing the Roman Empire. Now, I don't think that we have to limit the application to the Roman Empire. The points that are being made here are points that though they had a specific application at the time, there were principles that were being established that would apply to similar situations later on. So that you could say any time a nation, an empire, or a government turns its power over to the uses of Satan to persecute the saints, then you have a similar situation. See? Do you see that? So we have a specific situation being dealt with back here at the close of the first century. But it was a situation that would be repeated so that the principles that are laid down about this situation when a persecuting power or when a government turns its power over to the devil to persecute the saints and so on, then you have a similar situation. Now here in chapter, and I also wanted to mention, I went back and asked Jerry if he'd pretty well dealt with 666 and learned about, even indirectly, Jerry, I had it reported to me the last three numbers of your Social Security number, 666. So some thought we might have found the beast, and he said, well, that makes sense. Said some made the comment, that makes sense. Well, I don't think that makes sense. But I'll tell you another thing. Do you know what the phone number is over here? 2324-666. Well, I remember years ago, you know, this whole thing about premillennialism waxes and wanes. Mainly waxes, I'm afraid. But when they began to have barcodes, do you all remember the fuss that was made about barcodes and things like that? Oh, everybody began to, oh, this is the mark of the beast. This is going to get it where... And so we, you know, the world's always been a place where we look for razzle-dazzle. We look for something to get excited about. We look for something to get scared of. And the devil just loves it. Because when we get all upset and all up in the air about something like that, it takes the attention away from his most dangerous weapon, which is the ordinary temptations that we face every day to sin. And so, if we go to hell, it won't be because we had the wrong barcode. And if we go to hell, it won't be because we had some 666 as a part of some number connected with us. It'll be because we have given in to the devil and we walk with him instead of walking with God. Throughout the years, you can just read of just boo-koodles of explanations about 666. And most of them have to do with translating those numbers into names with six letters. But you have to be very arbitrary to do that. For example, if you were going to look at Nero's name in Greek, Nero doesn't even have six letters. And so you have to do some playing around with it to make it even have six. Merely because you find someone who has three names, each name six letters, that doesn't prove anything. And the thing about any interpretation like that, in the very nature of the interpretation, it is so arbitrary that how could you ever pin down which one it is? And so I just totally reject the idea that the 666 has to do with some man whose names, three names, and each name has six letters. No. I believe that probably the best explanation of that is that just as seven is the number of perfection, and six is the idea of falling short, the idea here is that throughout, these are not mythical beings. I think that's one point that's made throughout the chapter. This first beast, he's not a mythical being. This beast involves human beings. And that second beast, he's going to involve human beings. And this number here, the number of a man. In other words, it's not just the number of the beast, it's the number of a man. It's making the point that man is not God, and man is ever falling short. Man is not perfect. He cannot achieve divine goals, even though he imitates them. He seeks to do that. He cannot do it. So I just make that comment. Well, let's go ahead now and begin in chapter 14, where we see the Lamb standing on Mount Zion. Behold the Lamb standing. I saw and behold the Lamb standing on the Mount Zion, and with Him 144,000, having His name and the name of His Father written on their foreheads. Now as I study 13 and 14 and contrast those two chapters, there is an enormous, very, very emphatic contrast that leaps out at you. And that is, whereas with the beast there in chapter 13, you have the mark of the beast on the forehead, verse 17, that no man should be able to buy or to sell, save he that hath the mark, even the name of the beast or the number of his name. And verse 16 mentions, on their right hand or upon their forehead. Now then in 14, keeping that in mind, in 14, here are the 144,000 having the name of Jesus and the name of His Father written on their foreheads. So the first thing to do is just see that clearly, that over here on one side, we've got the servants of the beast with his mark on their forehead or on their right hand. And now here, in contrast, we have the followers of the Lamb who have the name of the Lamb and of his Father on their foreheads. So you see that simple contrast there? Well, now this mark doesn't mean it's a literal brand. The mark is in connection with the life and the character displayed. That's what it is. It's the character and the life that's displayed. When your character and your life reflect the designs of Satan, because Satan lies behind this. You see, if you remember the description of Satan in chapter 12, seven heads and ten horns, and here this first beast has seven heads, ten horns. He's not the devil, but he is so closely identified with the devil, having turned his power over, made it the devil's power to use as he will. And so it's the idea of the character of those who submit and partake of the way of the devil and the way of his servant, the beast. And so the children of God, who have the name of the Lamb upon their forehead and the name of the Father upon their forehead, these are the ones who submit unto the Father. And the description of them that is given, I think, makes that very, very clear as we go along. Now, this Mount Zion, I want to talk to you a minute about Mount Zion. In the Old Testament, when we studied the prophets, you remember we studied about Mount Zion a lot. We had a lot of references to Mount Zion. Now, Mount Zion starts out in the Old Testament as a literal place. It was a literal place. It was the ancient citadel that was built out on a ridge. If you take the area of Jerusalem, you have on the west side, you have a valley curving down like that, the valley of the Son of Hinnom. You have another valley coming down on the east side, which is the valley of the Kidron. They come down and they meet down here. Now, in New Testament days, there was yet another valley that was that sort of divided the city coming south, and it was called the Tyropian Valley. And the Tyropian Valley, if you take the ridge that was between the Tyropian Valley and the Kidron Valley, it was just a ridge, a fairly steep, precipitous ridge that extended out to the south. And the ancient Jebusite citadel was built out there on that ridge, and it was almost unattackable except from the north side. So all they had to do was make sure their fortifications were very strong on the north side, and they felt like they were just impregnable, that nobody can get in here. Well, the story is told then in the Old Testament that David gave the command, get up to the watercourse. And he made the comment that whoever conquers the city of the Jebusites would be captain of the host. And so Joab wound up to be the captain of the host. So it may have been, I think that most think that probably what happened was that they found a way up through a cave out which a spring flowed, the spring of Gihon. They went in there and found that there was a shaft that went up into the city, and that may be how they got into it. But anyway, David did capture that citadel, and that became Mount Zion, where the king dwelt. So that Mount Zion became, it was the capital of the king, where the king dwelt. Well, then Mount Zion became a spiritual thing, the idea of the capital of the kingdom of God, particularly the kingdom of God upon earth, God's kingdom here upon earth. So it also became the idea, this is where God dwells, in His capital, with His people, leading His people, guiding His people. When it came time for the idea of the Messiah to come and have His kingdom, then Mount Zion was the capital of His kingdom. So this is a spiritual thing. It is not a physical thing. But it is on earth. It is on earth. This is the kingdom of the Messiah. These people are the people who are in the kingdom of the Messiah on earth. Well, one of the points we've made in our study of the Messianic kingdom is that the Messianic kingdom, the rule of the Christ, includes far more than just the kingdom here on earth. That He rules over things in heaven, things on earth, things under the earth. He rules the living and the dead. Everything has been created through Him, and without Him was not anything made that hath been made. Now these 144,000, if you'll go back and notice in chapter 7, a few significant points about these 144,000. Chapter 7, verse 1, after this I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the what? That's verse 1. Of the earth. No wind should blow on the earth, the sea, or upon any tree. All right, go on down to verse 3. Saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads. So the location of this is the earth. And what is going to be done on the earth will have some impact upon these people. These are the people having to do with the earth. And yet, as it designates the 144,000 out of the various tribes, remember, what were some of the points we made to show that this could not have been literal? These were not the literal tribes of Israel. What were some of the points? Do you remember any significant point to show these could not have been the literal tribes of Israel? Ephraim is left out. There's more than one that's left out. Plus, you have 12,000 from each of the tribes that's named. Now you just think, what would be the chances that in each tribe it's going to round off to exactly 12,000? The big ones, the little ones? No. This is a symbolic number. But what it has to do is, these are the saints that are in the kingdom of God on earth at any given time. These are the ones who are in the fray. These are the ones who are in the struggle. They're still in the battle. Now, if you'll remember back over there in chapter 7, following the description of the 144,000, in verse 9, after these things I saw, and behold, a great multitude. No man can number. Out of every nation and of all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. Okay, now where are they? They on earth? They're in heaven. And so I believe that it's clear that these 144,000 are referring to the saints of God on earth in the Messianic kingdom at any given time. So here we have the contrast with here the two beasts in chapter 13 going about their efforts to kill and destroy and persecute and defeat the plan of God. Just like that second psalm talks about, why do the nations rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves. The rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed. Yet in spite of everything they do, God can say in verse 6 of Psalm 2, I have set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. All right, now keep in mind that the name of the Lamb and of the Father, the names of the Lamb and of the Father are written on their foreheads. Then he says, I heard a voice from heaven as the voice of many waters and as the voice of a great thunder. Similar to the description of the voice of Jesus there in the first chapter. You remember? The voice of Jesus in the first chapter is described in a similar way. And the voice which I heard was as the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And you know, I wonder, you imagine one harper with this little dinky harp going ting, 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 ting. Is that the picture you get of these harpers? I get the idea you've got a lot of harps. And the sound is a grand and glorious sound, as you would have with a lot of harps all being picked at once. And they sing, as it were, a new song before the throne. Now this idea of the new song, you know, there are so many wonderful, beautiful, fascinating ideas here as we go along in in Revelation. Got to remember what book I'm in. A new song. Why sing a new song? Well, throughout the Bible, there have been occasions when a new song was sung, such as when Moses and the children of Israel crossed over the Red Sea, having had the waters divided, and they crossed over, they sang a song. Now, why had they not sung that song before? Because they had never crossed the Red Sea before. They had never had the Red Sea divided for them. That was a one-time thing. They'd never had that before. And so when it happened, they sang a new song because no song had ever been written to celebrate that event. Well, these people are here singing a new song, a song that no one else has ever been able to celebrate, because they have absolutely been redeemed and they have been delivered from all sin. They have been delivered from oppression. They are not on the earth anymore. I'm talking about the great multitude back in chapter 7. But here, they sing, as it were, a new song before the throne. Now, this is a voice from heaven, verse 2. And they sing, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders. And no man could learn the song save the 144,000, even they that had been purchased out of earth. Now, it is definitely relating these 144,000 who are standing with the Lamb on Mount Zion. It's relating those 144,000 to a sure destiny, a reward that is in heaven. And it is because of who they are and because they have the name of the Son and the name of the Father upon their forehead. And look at how it describes them. They have been purchased out of the earth. See at the close of verse 3? They had been purchased out of the earth. Acts 20, verse 28, feed the church of the Lord, which He purchased with His own precious blood. They have been purchased. Second comment, these are they that were not defiled with women. Now, the point is not, as the Catholic Church would like to make it, that sexual activity, even in marriage, defiles. No, the point is that these men have not committed fornication. These men... These are they that were not defiled with women. They have not committed fornication, for they are virgins. In other words, remember that one of the themes in the Bible is that here we have the church, which is the bride of Christ. And the church, which is the bride of Christ, is pure and undefiled. So the point is just being here that these are those who have not compromised their spirituality. They have not given in to the blandishments of Satan. They have not given in to the threats and the persecution. They have not given in to any of that. They have not participated in the evils of their age. And that's the point being made. Again, these are symbolic because these would be men and women. See that? I mean, you wouldn't want to say there aren't any women among 144,000. No, these are symbolic of the redeemed, both men and women. But the symbol is going as if they were men. They're not redeemed. I mean, they're not defiled with women. So the idea is that these are pure and undefiled because they have not participated in the spiritual evils of their age. But it goes on and describes them. These are they that follow the Lamb whithersoever He goeth. See that? Now, that's very important to notice all of these descriptions that are being given. They are purchased. They are not defiled with women. They are virgins. Third, they follow the Lamb whithersoever He goeth. These were purchased from among men to be the first fruits unto God and unto the Lamb. And it continues, and in their mouth was found no lie. They are without blemish. Now, in talking about their being without blemish, it reminds me of the statement made in Ephesians 5 and verse 25. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave Himself up for it, that He might sanctify it, having cleansed it by the washing of water with the Word, that He might present the church to Himself, a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. The very same words, without blemish. It is without blemish, not because of their own perfection, but because they have submitted themselves to the Lamb and to the Lamb's blood, and not only to the Lamb's blood, but also to the character and the life that is revealed in the Lamb. And that's what it means. They have His name upon their forehead. They have the name of the Father upon their forehead. But these are the ones that have been purchased. They're redeemed. That's why they are without blemish. All right, so now we have a description. The two sides are clearly delineated. The followers of the beast and his assistant. The beast of the sea and then his assistant, the beast of the earth. You might even say his prophet, his henchman, his servant. And so the first beast is the servant of the dragon. The second beast is the servant of the first beast. And they're all three in cahoots together. But now we have this other group, the 144,000, the ones that have been redeemed. All right, now then, in verses 6 through 8, I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven. Now, mid-heaven is suggested by some to be the idea he's right straight overhead. And that may well be what it is. It could also be that instead of being up as high as the eagle flies, he's sort of mid-height. I don't know for sure which it is. But he's up there and he can be easily seen by all. And he has eternal good tidings to proclaim unto them that dwell on the earth and unto every nation and tribe and tongue and people. Now, as you look at this, one of the going explanations that I consider to be a fairly reasonable explanation is that this angel represents the idea of the preaching of the gospel. And whereas there are a lot of ideas that I think would just be rejected out of hand, a lot of ideas that might be given about this might be just rejected out of hand, I think that one is definitely worth considering. But there are a couple of things that give me pause about accepting that explanation. One of them is that in all of the New Testament, there is never one time that an angel proclaims the gospel to anyone. It is always through the earthen vessel. The Lord Himself did not ever tell anyone what to do to be saved. Even when He was dealing with Saul, remember, Saul said, "What would Thou have me to do, Lord?" What did the Lord say? Did He say, "Repent and be baptized"? And no, what did He tell him to do? Go into Damascus and there it'll be told you what you must do. And we see the angels dealing with various ones there of the apostles and so on, with Philip in connection with the eunuch. So as I look at that, I'm aware of that. And then the second thing is, look at what this angel says. He says with a great voice, "Fear God and give Him glory, for the hour of His judgment is come." Now, if you were being persecuted by a power that richly deserved the judgment of God, and the announcement was made that the hour of His judgment has come, would you consider that good news? I would consider that good news. And it would be eternal in the sense that throughout history, we are told over and over again that who rules in the affairs of men? It's God. That He raises up whom He will, He brings down whom He will. As Paul says in his sermon at Mars Hill, God has determined their appointed seasons and the bounds of their habitation. He made of one every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed seasons and the bounds of their habitation, that they should seek God. So if God determines the bounds of their habitation, or determines their appointed seasons and the bounds of their habitation, tell me, what those two things, what are those talking about? Their appointed seasons. God has determined their appointed seasons with regard to the nations. What does that mean? You can figure it out. What does that mean? The appointed seasons. The time. How long this empire is going to last. How long this government is going to last. And whether it lasts a long time or not has something to do with, for example, whether it pits itself against God or not. Whether it pits itself against His saints or not. Also, the bounds of the habitation. Now, what would the bounds of the habitation have to do with? What would that be? How big it got. Yeah. So how long it lasts, how big it gets. So it, to me, it makes more sense to think that this angel is telling the good news that God is in charge and He rules in the affairs of men, and never fear, He is bringing judgment upon these who oppose themselves to Him and who persecute the saints. That's certainly the message back in Daniel 7, and I think it's the message here too. To me, at least, that makes more sense. Rather than the angel here representing the idea of general preaching of the gospel, I think that it makes more sense to have him announcing the good tidings that he states right there with his great voice. Fear God and give Him glory, for the hour of His judgment is come, and worship Him that made the heaven and the earth and sea and fountains of waters. So this is there have been angels before. This is another angel. And then in verse 8, and another, a second angel. So here he's putting together the angel of verse 6, then verse 8, a second angel, then verse 9, another angel, a third. So he is specifically ranking these angels together, first, second, and third. So the first angel is giving the good news that God is in charge. Give Him the glory. The hour of His judgment is come. Worship Him that made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and the fountains of waters. Now the second angel announces, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Except, you know what? We really haven't even been introduced to Babylon as we will be later on. We have been introduced to the dragon, to the sea beast, to the earth beast, and now mention has been made of Babylon. And what we will observe is that as we go along and we see the judgment of God brought upon these, He will go in reverse order. He will first deal with the judgment of Babylon, and then the earth beast, the false prophet, and then the sea beast, empire, and then the devil himself. So, you know, just sort of keep that in mind, that He's introduced them, like in chapter 12. You have the dragon, the devil. 13, you have the sea beast, the empire, and the earth beast, the false prophet, probably emperor worship. The idea of the deification of the emperor and the tremendous pressure to force people to submit to him as deity. And then Babylon. And then when he deals with the judgment, when he shows their destruction and defeat, he will take Babylon down, and then the false prophet, and then the sea beast, and then the dragon. So just kind of keep that in mind as you go along through here. Now, we talked about the forehead, and I want to come back to that now, because this to me is one of the really, really powerful, practical lessons to be gotten out of this. Remind me, back in chapter 13, what was going to happen if you didn't have the mark of the beast upon your hand or your forehead? What could you not do? You couldn't buy, you couldn't sell. In other words, it'd be like, you're fired, you have no job, you can't sell anything to make a living, so you're just cut off. That's pretty bad, isn't it? Now that's pretty bad. So if you have the mark of the Lamb, or the name of the Lamb and of the Father on your forehead, then you don't have the mark of the beast, so that if you have the name of the Lamb and of the Father, then you can't buy or sell. But what can you do? And on the other hand, there are going to be some things of those who have the mark of the beast on their right hand and on their forehead. There are going to be some things that aren't going to be so good for them. And we're about to see what those things are. Notice in verse 9, "And another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a great voice, If any man worships the beast and his image and receiveth the mark on his forehead or upon his hand..." Oh, now back in 13 he said, if anyone does that, he'll be able to buy and sell. But this is telling us the news that if any man worships the beast and his image and receives a mark on his forehead or upon his hand, he also shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is prepared unmixed in the cup of his anger. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest day and night, they that worship the beast and his image, and whoso receiveth the mark of his name. So would you say that there is a kind of a trade-off? Would you say there's a kind of a trade-off? Okay, so tell me now, what's going to be the downside of those that have the name of the Lamb and the name of the Father on their forehead? What may they not be able to do? Buy and sell. So what might happen to them? They might even, They might even perish on earth. But then what? Everlasting life, victory before the throne of God. And so even though you look at them here at the end of their life, you might think, well, they sure lost. A few moments later, you see them. And then what would you say? They won. Big. But on the other hand, here are those that seem to have everything going real well here on earth. They've got the mark of the beast. Head. Hand. They can do, they can buy, sell, they can work, they can have their stuff and everything. But what's going to happen to them? What does he say here is going to happen to them? Tormented forever, day and night. So, you know, what do you think when you look at that? Isn't that a choice? Aren't we looking here at a choice? What is the choice? What are the choices? Fred? Those are the two choices. If we choose to obey God, what may we have to endure? Hardship, persecution. But in the end, eternal life. And I tell you again, over and over throughout the book, He will periodically transfer us, as it were, to heaven to see the state of the dead, to see how blessed they are, how full of joy and everything they are. So I think it is very, very powerful to contrast the idea of what's on the forehead and on the hand of those that follow the beast in 13, and then those that have the name of the Lamb and the Father upon their forehead in 14, and to see the contrast of what is going to happen.
These Christians would need that so much because think about what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15, that if there's no resurrection, there's no hope, and we're of all men most pitiable.
That's right.
And these Christians could look around, and if they lost their hope, they would realize we're sacrificing for nothing. But of course, they weren't. They just needed to be reminded just like we did.
That's right. If we have only hoped in this life, we are of all men most pitiable. But that is not the case, of course. Randy? That's right.
Continue on. Stay the course. Because in the end, there is.
And that you're referring. Yes. We want it all now. We want it all now. When it all is going to come afterward, we just have to remember we're going to get it all, but just not all now. And you're reading in verse 12 there, right? Here is the patience of the saints, they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus, meaning they keep at it. They don't give up. They don't quit. And you know, I guess it would be the very unusual person who never, never, ever has it crossed their mind that, well, I'll just quit. There's no sense in keeping on. But there is sense in keeping on. And here is the patience of the saints. Now, as is true so often in the New Testament, when you have the English word patience, it means more than just being able to wait on something. It means to be able to endure. That it's much more than just saying, well, I sure hate to burn up 2 hours sitting here in this office waiting on the doctor. No, it'd be like you're sitting there with a vise clamped on a finger. It'd be a whole lot harder to wait 2 hours with a vise clamped on your finger, or some of these horrible accidents I've seen with a pole stuck through you or something like that. You know, I mean, you're just sitting there waiting to see the doctor. You got a physical that day. That's one thing. That's patience. But the word here is more than that. It is patience in the sense of steadfastness, perseverance. Perseverance is really, really a good word to use in translating this. So here is the steadfastness of the saints, that they do not give up. See, you have to keep that contrast in mind. The saints know what the contrast is. They know about the beast. They know what's going on here. They know who's the power that's involved there. And they know the Lord. And they know the Father. And so here are your choices. And here's what's going to happen to those that follow the beast. Here's what's going to happen to those that follow the Lamb. You have a choice to make. Now, it's not easy, like you were saying, Randy, it's not easy to follow the Lamb. And the beast can make it awfully hard. The dragon can make it awfully hard. But here's the patience of the saint. Here's the steadfastness, the perseverance. They that keep the commandments of God. The commandments of God are God's instructions to us. This is how you live. This is what you think. This is what you believe. These are God's guidance. Charles, did you have your hand? Okay. Did you have a comment? That's right. Excellent. Yes, our God is able to deliver us. Okay, well, we'll stop for today, and we'll be ready for verse 13.